Boston University School of Law, recognized for excellence in legal education since 1872.
It's the faculty.
It's the students.
It's the curriculum.
It's the inspiration.
Preparing students for the real-world practice of law today. Join host Dan Ray, BU Law alum and WBC 1030 radio host in Boston, for this edition of the BU Law Podcast.
Well, welcome in, everyone, to this edition of the Boston University School of Law podcast. I'm Dan Ray, and as mentioned, I'm a graduate of Boston University Law School way back in the 20th century. Seems like a long time ago. I practiced law here in Massachusetts, but also practiced journalism for 31 years at WBZ-TV, the CBS affiliate here in Boston, and now host Nightside on WBZ Radio on every Monday through Friday night from 8 to midnight on WBZ 1030 in the AM dial. And as a reporter, I covered countless cases in local, state, and national courtrooms, federal courtrooms. And as I mentioned, you can listen to my program Monday through Friday on WBZ News Radio 1030 from 8 to midnight East Coast time. Our guest today is Cornelius Hurley. He's the professor of the practice of banking law at Boston University School of Law. He's also the director of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Boston. He's a director there and a former assistant general counsel of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Professor Hurley teaches courses in banking structure and regulation. He has written articles for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Financial Times, and the Boston Globe. Currently serves as a reporter to the American Bar Association's Task Force on Financial Markets Regulatory Reform. Throughout the current economic crisis, he has provided expert analysis on national and local television and radio and has served as the director of the Morin Center for Banking and Financial Law at Boston University since 2005. Welcome to the BU Law School podcast, Professor Hurley.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be with you.
Well, we have a lot to cover. I do want you to know I had a chance to read yesterday afternoon the piece that you wrote, "Paying the Price for Too Big to Fail." Clearly, this is an area of love for you. There's no doubt about that. But even if you are not an expert in the field of banking law and financial regulation, as you are, Americans, everyday Americans, are all too aware of. We can call it the economic downturn that began just around this time 2 years ago in September of 2008 when we witnessed the near collapse of Bear Stearns and, of course, what happened to Lehman Brothers, followed by a series of government interventions to save certain institutions that were deemed too big to fail. In your recently published article, you discussed this concept. So how did we get to the point where the failure of a single bank apparently can threaten the entire economy of the United States of America, if not the economy of the world?
Well, I wish I had the silver bullet answer to that. But before we get into the substance of this, I just like to say another tip of the hat to you, Dan, for the heroic work you did with Victor Garrow on the Sovati matter.
Well, thank you very much.
Nothing short of remarkable, and you have many people's respect and admiration for that.
I appreciate that very much, Professor.
Everybody today, 2 years, as you point out, after the gun went off on the crisis, which for a lot of folks was September 15th, the failure of Lehman, everybody has their own pet view of what caused it. My own fairly simplistic explanation for it is three things. Number one, size. Number two, complexity, and number three, ignorance. And I think it's the toxic combination of those three things that put us where we were in 2008. And oh, by the way, I think we're in that same spot today, which we'll probably talk about more later. But if you go back 15 years, the six largest banks in the U.S. counted for only about 20% of the entire financial system. Today, those same six banks occupy the field. They account for roughly 65% of the financial system and, by the way, almost an equal percentage of gross domestic product. And then you add on top of that the explosion of complex and almost incomprehensible products within those institutions that were understood neither by their creators nor the boards of directors of companies that oversaw them, nor by their regulators. then you that leads you to the third element, which I call the ignorance, which was just whistling by the graveyard by regulators, managements, markets, investors, counterparties. And I guess in retrospect, it's easy to say that there it's no surprise, but the fact that it was a surprise is the surprise. people didn't see it coming.
I remember driving through Phoenix, Arizona back, I think it was probably in 2007, and looking at the construction, blocks upon blocks upon blocks of condominiums or rental units. I mean, literally driving for miles. And at that time, thinking, who's going to buy these properties? Who's going to live here? And I just wish I had made the connection way back then. On this concept of too big to fail, which is a concept that I think is really antithetical to the concept of what most of us understand the free market and capitalism to be. Do you agree with the too big to fail concept, or should the fate of such companies have been allowed to fail in the free market?
Yeah, well, too big to fail, that policy initiative has been with us for a long time, and it's really the essence of what central banking is all about is lending into a crisis, into a panic, to quell that panic. It goes back actually a century and a half, but the most recent incarnations of it were long-term capital management in the late 90s, and just before that, in the mid 80s, you had the Continental Illinois Bank debacle, and then you had the savings and loan crisis. So that's the essence of central banking. Where this thing went off the tracks, I believe, is that with Lehman, it was allowed to fail. And most of the policymakers now admit that by letting that one fail, they caused a whole series of dominoes to fall that we're still picking up the pieces today. So, for example, Chairman Bernanke and former Secretary Paulson claim that at the time they did not have the legal authority to bail out Lehman. Well, I think that's rather disingenuous, because the same authority that they had to bail out Bear Stearns barely 6 or 9 months earlier was there at the time of Lehman. So it's the sheer randomness of too big to fail as it's and been implemented as a policy that is causing the confusion and the lack of confidence in the markets today. The policy itself, there is a place for the policy in central banking and in our economic system. There is not a place for arbitrary use of that policy, however.
So the concept, this is what I'm trying to get my arms around, if you will. We've seen over time big corporations go belly up. I used to work for a corporation called Westinghouse Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. It's gone. There are airlines which no longer exist, Eastern Airlines. Is it something endemic to the banking industry that's such a linchpin in the economy that there needs to be certain institutions that are too big to fail? Is it just the banking industry that the too big to fail concept is necessary?
Well, I don't think you can say that it's the industry per se, but it's certainly certain players within that industry that were allowed to become so large and complex that the spillover effect from them, their failure, was either so catastrophic or so imponderable that they would and could not be allowed to fail. So, for example, every Friday we read about certain smaller banks failing. And in fact, several larger banks, $20, $30 billion banks, have failed through this crisis. And those are probably more akin to the companies that you mentioned in the economic sphere rather than the financial sphere. But I think when we allow institutions to occupy so much of the field as we have with the likes of Citi, Goldman, Chase, Wells, Morgan Stanley, B of A, then we are really setting ourselves up for a continuation of this policy.
The Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform legislation and other consumer protection acts of this nature, but the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act tries to protect against banks becoming too big to fail through the creation of the Financial Stability Oversight Council. Once again, another government agency giving it the authority to limit the actions of any bank with over $50 billion in assets if its actions are considered a threat to the broader system. Sounds great. More government regulation, antithetical to me philosophically. What do you think? Do you think this will be effective?
No, I don't. Well, it depends on what you call effective. There are 26 institutions that fall into that category that you mentioned, namely over $50 billion. However, the six that I mentioned are over, in some cases, over $2 trillion in assets. So we've set ourselves up for a situation where any of those 20 could fail, right? And the markets would adjust for them. However, the top six, we cannot allow to fail. So now that the 26 are going to be under the warm embrace of the Fed, I think what you'll see is when any one of those 20, over $50 billion, but not in the big six, gets in trouble, the Fed will politely suggest or insist that they be absorbed into the six. Are you with me?
I'm with you totally, but this seems to, and again, I don't mean to interrupt you, but this seems to go against the entire concept of antitrust provisions in this country, that we're, that the government is in effect allowing the consolidation of power and influence and encouraging it.
It certainly does, but we've always had built into antitrust law and interstate banking law and many other laws an override provision where if it's deemed to be in the public interest, and for this case being in the public interest would be saving the financial system from calamity,
yep.
Then those well-founded statutes are usually shunted to the side.
Yeah, no, I do understand that. Another component of the Dodd-Frank bill is the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, headed by a law professor from across the river, Elizabeth Warren, who ran the TARP Congressional Oversight Panel. How's that all going to work?
First of all, it's a incredibly powerful bureau that's been set up. It's within the Fed. However, it's almost autonomous from the Fed. And when I say almost, it's operationally it is autonomous. The only oversight that the Fed has of it is indirectly through its Inspector General's office. Its budget comes right off the top, 10% or 12% of the Fed's annual net income, which in a lot of years is in the order of $40 to $60 billion. So we're looking at an agency that out of the gate has a budget of say $600 million, which is significant because of the number, but more importantly it's significant because of the lack of congressional oversight. Most agencies and commissions get their appropriations from Congress, so there are some checks and balances in place here. There are none with this. The only weapon that Congress has is to abolish the agency, just as it created it. So you combine that with the fact that the appointment, as its not its director, but its czar, for a want of a better word, is kind of a backdoor appointment, and it's and you have the recipe for not a successful endeavor.
Yeah. Some are claiming that obviously the president's appointment of Professor Warren, as it was done, is actually unconstitutional, and that she should have been run through the congressional process, like any other major appointee. At the same time, I'm sure that his appointment of her is under the radar screen of most Americans, that probably 1% of the Americans know about that controversy. Is that important, do you think, how she came to this position?
Well, I think it is important. Whether it's unconstitutional or not, I'm not sure. I do think that in addition to the constitutionality of the appointment, it raises a question as to the legitimacy of any rules or administrative actions that she, as the one-person head of this new agency, might take. So in that regard, I go back to my earlier comment about its launch not being the most effective. But, you know, this has been, you know, you're talking to a guy that took the summer of 2008 off to work for the election of President Obama. So my comments are out of affection and desire for his success rather than stern critique.
But, no, I understand I appreciate the difference.
Yeah, my problem is with this appointment or lack of appointment, as with many other things, whether it's healthcare or Guantanamo or cap and trade, is that just take a principled stand and lose on the Senate floor or lose on the House floor. But don't back down without even putting it to a vote.
And yeah, and this of course, was an administration that was going to provide us with here-to-date transparency like no other.
Yeah. I think the administration has lost sight of the value of fighting the good fight.
Let me just switch here real quickly, if I can. Significant debate about policies advocated by Paul Volcker. He's an Obama advisor and, of course, former chairman of the Fed. I think he was chairman of the Fed under Reagan, going back that far. I think I'm right on that.
I actually worked for Paul Volcker in the 70s. And I have tremendous admiration for him.
Right, and Reagan held him over, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, so what I'm saying, this is a guy who worked not only for Ronald Reagan, now works for President Obama. What can you tell us about the so-called Volcker Rule and its legal implications?
Well, the Volcker Rule, you may recall, was advocated, obviously, by former Chairman Volcker early on in the administration, but it was rejected by Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, until mid-January of 2010, when something odd happened here in Massachusetts. We elected a Republican senator. 2 days later, they dragged out the Volcker Rule and announced that it was a cornerstone of the legislative agenda. And I think it was a good idea all along. However, if you were going to have that as your cornerstone, you needed to build a different building to carry its weight rather than have it just be a brick on top of the house of cards.
And what exactly does the Volcker Rule purport to do?
What the Volcker Rule is designed to do is remove banks and bank holding companies from owning and investing in private equity firms, hedge funds, and trading securities and other assets for their own account. In other words, the Volcker Rule is designed to make banks true intermediaries between depositors and other creditors and the users of funds. One of the problems with the Volcker Rule and one of the problems with dragging it out virtually at the end of the legislative process is its success is keyed to global adoption. In other words, if our banks adopt the Volcker Rule and HSBC and Santander and UBS go their own merry way,
then we're at a disadvantage.
Does that leave our banks vis-a-vis the global community? So the proper way to have gone about this would have been to lobby the G20 and the international regulatory community to get some consensus on this policy initiative. Not to pull the rabbit out of the hat because you suffered an electoral defeat in Massachusetts.
The Volcker Rule, is that intended to undercut some of the, again, I'll use the word liberalization here. I'm not sure if that's the correct word, of the bill the President Clinton signed back in November of 1999, was at that time called the Graham-Lynch Bealey Act. I think that's the way it is pronounced. That sort of changed banking dramatically, going back to standards that were set up in this country at the height of the Depression in the mid-30s. And that really did, from what I understand, change the basic ground rules of banking. Would the Volcker Rule cut back on some of that that legislative freedom that President Clinton signed in 99?
Yeah, there's some of that flavor in the Volcker Rule. You know, there are three major statutes historically, going back to the Depression, that deal with the same issue, which is the separation of traditional banking from investment banking. And those are the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, and then you point out the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999, and then finally the Dodd-Frank Act. And Glass-Steagall laid down specific and stern markers that required Morgan Trust, for example, to spin off what became Morgan Stanley and other divestitures at the time. And that's what we lived with for 75, 80 years, what was called the Great Moderation. And it worked pretty well. And it worked pretty well. But the globalization and technology and information systems eroded it over time. So by the time Congress got around to enacting the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999, that barrier that had been set up by Glass-Steagall was pretty much gone. Graham-Leach-Bliley was more or less an after-the-fact validation of what had gone on in the marketplaces. But that validation and that eroding of the wall, combined with size and complexity that we talked about earlier, and a healthy dose of ignorance, got us to the situation where we were. And what I think Chairman Volcker is trying to do is to return us to a saner period. He's famous for saying, for example, that, you know, the people that oppose this stuff say, well, what's going to happen to innovation? America's so well-regarded for innovation and creativity. What's going to happen to innovation? And Paul Volcker famously retorts that the most creative and most value-driven innovation that's occurred in the banking industry in his career has been the ATM machine.
We're going to take a quick break here on that note. My guest today on the Boston University Law School podcast is Professor Cornelius Hurley, and we're going to be back with Professor Hurley. More conversation right after this break.
Located in Boston and steeped in 138 years of rich tradition, BU Law is number one in teaching quality according to Leiter Law School rankings and number three in the nation for best professors according to Princeton Review. BU Law, admitting students regardless of race, religion, or gender since 1872 and training them to become leaders in the law. Visit the website and see for yourself at www.bu.edu/law. Now back to the BU Law Podcast with host Dan Ray, a lawyer, a veteran Boston broadcast journalist, and BU Law alum.
And welcome back to this edition of the Boston University School of Law podcast. I'm Dan Ray. My guest today is Professor Cornelius Hurley. Professor Hurley, what would have you have done differently from what the Obama administration and Congress have done in the last couple of years to reform the financial system? Or have they done enough would be another way to ask that question.
Quite frankly, that they've done too much and they've done the wrong things. I'm a big fan of simplicity. Maybe it's a tribute to my own limited capacity for comprehension. But two things that I would have done differently is with respect to systemic risk. The statute sets up an immovable force and what's an irresistible object. In that it directs this new Oversight Council to eliminate, and stay with me on this, eliminate the perception that there will be bailouts of systemically important institutions. Well, if you're going to accomplish that, you have to admit that if there is any systemically important institution like the Big Six that I mentioned, then there obviously is built into that the perception that they will be bailed out.
Sure.
So what I would have done in the statute is I would have set up a mechanism that says something like the following. Look, We know that the Big Six are subsidized. They're subsidized every day, not through TARP or anything else, but by the fact that they can borrow in the capital markets from depositors and others at materially lower rates than all of their competitors can. And that advantage translates into tens, if not hundreds, of billions of dollars on an annual basis. On an annual basis. So I would take that subsidy that we, the taxpayers, confer on them by the perception of the bailout, and I would put it in a segregated account on their balance sheet, something called I call a subsidy reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, the rule would be, not this is the Hurley rule, not the Volcker rule.
Right.
But the Hurley rule would be the only way you can unlock the value of that subsidy reserve for your shareholders is through a divestiture of a company or a sale of a division, in which case some of that reserve goes with it and it's reduced. But until then, the reserve builds up and up until ultimately the bank becomes too safe to fail.
Yeah.
So I would leave it up to shareholders, not regulators, but shareholders to determine when that company is so inefficient, so overcapitalized that it's time to break it up into smaller pieces. So that would have been my answer to that. On the consumer side, as I mentioned, I worked at the Fed, and there are seven governors there. They're appointed for 14-year terms. One of the provisions of Dodd-Frank actually designates one of the seven governors as a supervision governor, and he or she will be responsible for this too-big-to-fail matter. I would have simply amended the Federal Reserve Act to say, hey, look, from now on, one of the seven governors is the consumer governor, and he or she is the person that is going to have to answer to Congress for the enforcement of the dozen or so consumer laws that are already lodged in the Fed. I wouldn't have created a whole new bureaucracy and with $600 million budget and so on.
One quick final question, and I know it's probably a totally speculative question, but the economy is still not back. We see unemployment up around 10%. Who knows what the real figure is? Those who have given up. We know that the stock market can't even get back to 11,000. When do you think our economy is going to finally get back on track? Or do you think that this is going to be such a slow creep and crawl that it's going to be years and years before we have anything that anyone could consider a full recovery?
Well, everything I read and contemplate sadly points to a Japanese style recovery, namely years and years. It's regrettable. You know, in addition to what you mentioned, unemployment, housing looks like it's headed for a double dip. We'll see probably in the next 6 months. There aren't very many positive signs out there. But going back to the actual topic that we're discussing here, Graham Leach Bliley, and we have these other major capital rules coming out of Switzerland called Basel III. These two phenomena, the legislation and the Basel rules, are to play out over the next, in some case, 5, 6, 7 years. And, you know, my God, Obama on the campaign trail used to talk about he used to quote Martin Luther King about the fierce urgency of now.
Right.
I think there should be a fierce urgency of now when it comes to writing rules under the new law and implementing the Basel Accords. But that urgency doesn't seem to be there. I think there's positive developments in that Secretary or Advisor Summers has moved on. Chief of Staff Emanuel has moved on. I would expect if the elections do not go the administration's way on November, Secretary Geithner will be moving on as well. So perhaps a new economic team can restore that fierce urgency that we all wish someone had today.
All right. Well, of course, Peter Rorzag also has moved on. He's not the only one. So
and Peter Rorzag and Romer and
yep, Christine Roma. Yep. I'd like to thank you, Professor Hurley, for being with us today. These are difficult issues for lawyers and non-lawyers alike to comprehend, but you make it easy to understand. How can listeners get in touch with you if they want more information on today's topic or banking law or the Moran Center at Boston University? What's the easiest way to get in touch?
Well, my email address is banklaw, that's one word, at bu.edu. If I could give a 30-second plug here, one of the exciting things we're doing under the direction of Maureen O'Rourke and President Brown is we are converting the Moran Center into a resource of the university. So the Moran Center going forward will probably not be known as something like the Institute of Finance, Law, and Policy, recognizing that all of the issues that you and I have been talking about today, Dan, are interdisciplinary. You know, the answers to them, we feel, do not reside just here in the law school or in the School of Management or in the Economics Department or the School of Communications or Metropolitan, but they lie in tremendous inventory of faculty and students that we have in each of those schools and colleges. So we're going to be, there'll be more to learn on this and hear on this, but we're going to establish an institute that goes at these problems from an interdisciplinary perspective.
And not to joke about it, but you got to get the divinity schools involved there too, because at some point we may have to do a lot of praying.
Yeah.
Professor Hurley, absolutely, thank you very, very much. Okay. I've really enjoyed it.
My pleasure.
I want to thank all of our listeners. You can find all of the editions of the Boston University School of Law podcast on the Legal Talk Network and on the Boston University School of Law website, as well as on iTunes. And until we next meet, I hope all of you have a great day and hope all of your bank accounts continue to grow. Good evening, everyone.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. Thanks for listening to the BU Law Podcast with host Dan Ray. Check out what else is happening on campus at bu.edu/law.